Now, Eric, the bell rings. We get to the middle of the ring. I'm a southpaw, but you throw your the most popular punch is a jab. You throw your jab, and this is what I do in the beginning of every fight. You throw your jab, I slip it, I throw an uppercut. I land it, right? We get back to the middle of the ring. You throw a jab, I slip it, throw an uppercut. You throw a jab, I slip it, throw an uppercut. The fourth time, you throw a jab, I slip it, you instinctively close your eyes because you know you're going to get hit. But then you don't get hit. So then you kind of peek your eyes open, and it's me smiling. So now you know if you throw that jab again, I can hit you at will. I can hit you so easily that I'll just pass up opportunities to hit you because I can just hit you later. Now, what that does is you're now afraid to throw your jab. So if you've ever been watching a boxing match and you're like, why isn't he throwing any punches? Because I've conditioned him not to.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Cam F. Awesome. Cam has won more boxing matches than anyone in the history of the sport. He's also the most decorated boxer in history. Today, he is a public speaker. He travels around the country. He shares the lessons that he learned as a boxer, lessons about mental toughness and having a mindset for confidence. Now, when I first met Cam, he told me that he had figured out early on in his boxing career that boxing is more about mindset than it is about strength, and that he was able to win all of those boxing matches because he had the mental game figured out. When I heard that, I said, oh my goodness, that's exactly the kind of mindset that I talk about on my podcast. I got to have you as a guest. And yes, his legal name is Cam F. Awesome. And I think that his story will inspire you to have the same kind of confidence in yourself, maybe not to change your name to Awesome, but to become awesome. It was a great conversation, and he has a lot of wisdom to share. Here's my conversation with Cam F. Awesome. How did you get started? I mean, you have a great story, so I'm just going to kind of let you tell your story as you see fit, and I'll ask you questions as you go along.
Yeah, when growing up, I wasn't a very confident person, and I think a lot of it had to do with my weight. And when I was 14, about 14 or 15, it was explained to me how calories work.
And not before that, huh?
It's like, it never occurred to me. No one said like, so they explained like your body burns about 2,000 calories a day. You eat this much. And what I took from that information, when I stripped everything down of all of the nonsense, I realized if I burn more calories than I consume, I will lose weight. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at it like that, so I did an experiment. I wanted to lose weight. And I thought the only way to do that before was play a sport. So I tried out for the basketball team and the football team every year. And I never made the team because I'm not very athletic. And when I learned about calories, I figured, oh, if I just rollerbladed for 2 hours every morning before school, I would burn more calories. Because I wasn't going to consume less calories. I was just going to burn more. That's how my brain worked.
Yeah.
So, and I realized after I did this morning after morning after morning after morning after morning, it had been five mornings and no one had stopped to say, Cam, you're looking good. I can tell you're losing weight. And that part bothered me. I remember that part bothered me because I'm like, am I doing this for no reason?
Uh-huh. And you expected results in 5 days.
Yes. I didn't understand what delayed gratification was, but it was upsetting to me. But I bet on the formula because if I burn more calories than I consume, I will lose weight. That's how it works, right? That is. Mm-hmm. So if I continue this in 2 months, if I'm not losing weight, something's wrong. And after 2 months, people started saying, oh, you look a skinny boy. And it would make me feel so good. And after I lost enough weight, my goal was to go to the boxing gym, but because I realized with the boxing gym, I didn't need to make a team so I could automatically compete. Mm-hmm. But I was nervous to go to the boxing gym because I didn't want to be the fat kid going to the boxing gym.
Okay.
So I made sure I worked out for months before I went to the boxing gym. And I went to the boxing gym. I said, I just want to do the workout so I can look like a boxer. I don't want to hit anyone. I do not want to get hit.
So why boxing? I mean, you said you were kind of interested in competition. So competition kind of involves, you know, the interaction of hitting people.
Or
you just wanted to call yourself a boxer because, you know, you did the workouts.
Oh, I just wanted to look like a boxer.
Okay.
Because if I looked like a boxer, like I wouldn't get bullied anymore and people would stop picking on me.
Okay. Okay.
And if I looked like a boxer, I'd probably get a date to prom.
Which
is also part of the motivation.
Yeah. Yeah. benefit on both sides there.
Yeah. So I completely, like, this is the first thing I was ever allowed to participate in sports wise. So I was so excited I was allowed to be there. It opened up at 4 p.m. I was there at 4 p.m. They closed the doors at 8 p.m. I was there when they closed the doors.
Okay.
5 days a week, I did not miss the gym. I was so happy to be somewhere and what I thought was the more I worked out, the more calories I burned, the faster I'm going to look like a big, scary boxer, mm-hmm. the quicker I get a date to prom. That was the motivation here.
Well, and at that age, that all makes sense. I mean, that just, but nobody would tell you. Yeah.
And it was an important lesson though, because after I started working out, after about 6 months, I got in better shape than all the other boxers. And the coach said one day in front of everyone, "Hey Cam, you're in great shape now. Why don't you spar?" And I said, "Oh, my mom's not going to let me." Everyone laughed, and I was like, "I'm joking, guys. I'm joking. I'll get a mouthpiece." And I got pressured into it, and I was so afraid the first time I sparred, I was so afraid to get hit that my only focus, my sole focus, was not to get hit. Crazy thing happened. I didn't get hit.
Wow.
So this is the equation I figured out. The same equation, if I burn more calories than I consume, I will lose weight. So this equation is 1 + 2 = 3. In this equation, you are 1 because you mm-hmm. should always be number 1. You should be your number 1. You should be your biggest fan. If you don't believe you're going to do something, why should anyone else believe in you? So you're number 1. Number 3 is your goal, what you want to achieve. So how do you get to 3? 1 + 2 = 3. You need to take number 2. So the reason why I call it number 2 is it is what it sounds like. It's the crappy part of the job. Okay.
That's kind of what I was thinking. I was like, okay, well, this.
Yeah, it's the hard work.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
And so in my equation, for me to win in boxing, because the first time I sparred, I realized what the equation was. 1 + 2 = 3. I'm 1. 3 is me winning in boxing. 2 is me not getting hit. So if I could just figure out how not to get hit, I win. That is the equation. And with that equation, in 2 years, I was number 1 ranked boxer in the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
So as I'm listening to this, it's like something's missing. You also have to do some hitting to to win. I mean, not getting hit's a good thing, but yeah.
So let me explain. So this is the equation is not getting hit.
Not getting hit.
So what I did is I fought at super heavyweight. So I weighed about 205 pounds, but I was fighting guys 260, 270.
Wow. That's quite a big discrepancy there.
Everyone thought I was crazy, but here's my logic. The bigger guys are slower. So what I would do is I would test your gas tank. So let's say it's you and I, right? We're fighting each other. In the beginning of the fight, I say, let's see what's in your gas tank. By that, I mean, how hard have you worked out? How hard have you prepared? Are you in good enough shape? So I move around a lot the first round. I don't care about hitting you at all, right? So I'm moving around, which makes you move around a lot. Now we're both burning energy. Mm-hmm. The first round happens. Neither of us barely hit each other. It's a wash. The second round, I know your coach is going to tell you, hey, jump on him. So I'm gonna be very careful the first minute of the second round. But then you're going to get tired. I'm not going to get tired. So then now that you're desperate and you're swinging at me, your coach told you to start attacking me. You swing with a wild hook. I pull back. I touch you with a light jab. Now I hit you once. You haven't hit me at all. You need to get your punch back. So mm-hmm. Now you throw a two-punch combination. Pop, pop. I slip, slip. Pop, pop. I hit you three times. Granted, I haven't hurt you at all, but it's hard for me to lose if I'm not getting hit.
Yeah.
Now, by the time the third round comes, you're desperate and you're fatigued. So now that's when I start fighting. And so a lot of my times I knock out fighters. It's not that I hurt them. It's I literally hit them with so many punches and they can't defend themselves because they can't keep their hands up that the ref stops it and calls the fight off.
That.
1 + 2 = 3. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's any equation you want in life, you can strip it down to 1 + 2 = 3. But for that equation to work, you have to remove your feelings.
Okay.
And what I mean,
what does that mean?
So 1 + 2 = 3. You were 1, 3 is a goal. Now 2, you can do 2 if you're hungry. You can do 2 while you're sad. You can do 2 while you're happy. You can be positive while you do 2. You can be an optimistic. You can be a pessimist. But regardless, for this equation to work, you need to accomplish number 2, right? Mm-hmm. People are more likely to be discouraged if they have a negative attitude.
Yeah, that's true.
And a negative attitude is nothing but your feelings. And that's when you're discouraged. Well, I tried this. I tried twice and it didn't work out the way I thought it was going to work out. And now I don't want to try again. And that's what quitting is. It's you being discouraged. Mm-hmm. But if you can fail without being discouraged, success is inevitable.
That's true. Yeah.
So in my story in boxing, within 2 years, I qualified for the 2008 Olympic trials. Like I was super excited. It was a big deal. I was boxing less than 2 years. I qualified for the Olympic trials. I'd never made a team before. Mm-hmm. I got to the Olympic trials. I lost the first day.
In the Olympic trials. Yeah,
in the Olympic trials. I lost the first day. But here's what I realized. All of those boxers were going to turn pro. And I'm going to be the only one left.
Okay.
So if I stick around, I'm going to be one of the best boxers around. Because all the experienced guys have left. And really, in boxing, whoever's more experienced usually wins. That's okay. The bottom line. So when all those guys turned pro and I stuck around, I won nationals in 2008 because I didn't quit. Most boxers either turn pro or they quit. I didn't quit. So I stuck around. I won nationals. And then I realized something.
So that was the same year you had the Olympic trials.
Yeah. I came back right after that and won nationals.
Okay.
Yeah. But that has been my whole model. The whole, if you fail without being discouraged, success becomes inevitable. Because after I won in 2008, more people were surprised that I won than I was because I'm this little 205-pound guy and I'm beating these giants and no one can figure out how I'm doing it. I know I'm mentally prepared. I'm physically prepared and I know the equation. And I figured if I won nationals once and this equation works, because any equation, if you strip it down, it will always work indefinitely, universally. If that's true, I can win nationals next year.
Uh-huh.
And I did. And then I won the year after and the year after. And I've won more national championships than anyone else in the history of the sport.
Just by not quitting.
Yeah, by following the equation. Now, in 2008, I lost the Olympic trials. I came back. I won nationals in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. In 2012, I returned to the Olympic trials. I won the Olympic trials. And then I became the first boxer to be suspended and kicked off the Olympic team for not filling out paperwork.
For not filling out paperwork.
Yeah. I won the Olympic trials here in America, and I went to fight in Azerbaijan. I went to go find a country in Azerbaijan, and I forgot to tell the drug testing agency I was leaving the country. So they showed up to my house here in Lenexa, Kansas, to give me a random drug test. And I wasn't there. And even though I tested negative that same week to compete in that tournament in Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. by the same drug testing organization, I was still suspended. Now, this is the first time anyone has ever been suspended for this offense.
Uh-huh.
It's not a real offense. But it was after Lance Armstrong went on Oprah. And they cracked down on 13 athletes. I happened to be one of them.
Yeah. That more political than – yeah. Yeah, it's politics. That's unfortunate.
It was a bad year for me. I gained 70 pounds, didn't leave my house for about a year. I was very depressed because I felt like I was literally on my way to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. You'd been working at it for 4 years.
For 4 years. I didn't visit family. I didn't celebrate holidays. The way I dedicated my life from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. in the boxing gym, that's what I did for boxing. In high school, I walked 6 miles a day to the boxing gym, 3 hours a day, 5 times a week. That was what I was doing when I was 17. That's okay. The dedication. My whole life was boxing. And then I had the only thing I knew how to do taken away from me.
Wow. So what did you go after? I mean, you went into that kind of depression. How did you get yourself out of that? And what did you do then?
I actually lost a bet, and, Manny Pacquiao versus Timothy Bradley. Do you know who Pacquiao is?
No, I don't. I don't follow boxing that closely. Okay. So
Pacquiao is a big name guy. Timothy Bradley, I'd never heard of his name before. So I bet Pacquiao, and I lost that bet, which meant I had to be vegan for 28 days.
That sounds there's some background to that story. Why is that the bet?
So during my year off, during my suspension, I had no other way to make an income. So I started doing boxing training, and one of the clients I was training was vegan. So I made a bet with him, like, because Timothy Bradley was vegan, and of course Timothy Bradley wasn't going to win. So I had to be vegan for 28 days, but I didn't know at the time that the diet entails sobriety.
Okay. I did not know that either.
Yeah. I wouldn't have made the bet if I knew.
Is alcohol? I mean, I've seen memes on Facebook, kind of poking fun at vegans and saying, you know, beer is vegan, all of these different things.
Vegan just means no animal product. This was more of a plant-based diet. So it's like no processed foods, no oil, no fat, no sugar.
Okay.
No alcohol. So being a man of my word, I decided to be sober for 28 days, which was very difficult for me during this time of my life. And after 28 days, I lost 32 pounds, and I realized what a negative person I had become. And it kind of took me out of a bad spot.
So even with all of your, all of your dedication and everything in the boxing leading up to that, you had that devotion, I guess, that drive to succeed, but still needed to, have some mindset work done.
Yeah. So when I was walking to the boxing gym, the 3 hours, 5 days a week, I didn't, this was before there was music on your phone. So I had an MP3 player, but I couldn't afford batteries for it.
Okay.
So I would just have to make up stories in my head to entertain myself while I walk for 3 hours. And if I'm going to make up a story, of course I'm going to be the protagonist of my own story.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm making up stories of I'm this badass boxer. I'm beating everyone up. Oh, everyone's afraid to fight me. I'm winning everything. And I would make up these stories for 3 hours and then go train. And what I was doing is I was basically speaking it into existence. It was affirmations followed by actions every day. Mm-hmm. 3 hours of positive affirmations of how great I am, followed by actions. And that built a confident person. That's what kind of built my momentum, because boxing is a lot of it's mental. And I became this strong mentally person who believed in myself. And the more I believed in myself, the further I pushed my potential. The further I was able to push my potential, the more it made me believe in myself. Mm-hmm. It was like a feedback loop. But then after I got suspended, it was hard for me to get in shape again. Because
right. Yeah, that kind of loss is hard to take, especially just the whole circumstances and the way that it came down. Yeah, I could see that would really shake your confidence.
Yeah. And you know, when you're winning everything and you think you're unstoppable and you're on top of the world, it's not that hard to convince yourself you can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got to the point where it was hard for me to get myself to work out 2 or 3 days in a row. I would start for a little bit and fall off the wagon. And I realized that the difference between me in 2012 when I was suspended and me in 2006 when I was walking to the gym was, in 2006, I was my biggest fan. I was telling myself how great I was. I was telling myself all the great things I would accomplish. But in 2012, I was being so hard on myself. I'll call myself an idiot. I'll call myself dumb. There's so many of us who we badger ourselves. We're our biggest critic.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it clicked to me. Why am I my biggest critic? Shouldn't I think I'm going to accomplish what I'm going to accomplish? Shouldn't I be my biggest fan?
Mm-hmm.
Then a light bulb hit off and I realized, oh, there's a flaw in humility.
That's interesting.
There's a flaw in being humble outside of the religious context. If we can step outside the religious context. The definition of humble is to show low social, administrative, or political rank, having or showing low estimate of one's own importance. Now, would you want your child to show a modest or low estimate of their importance?
No. Well, I wouldn't want that for anybody.
Why would you want that for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, and see, you never think about, you know, when you talk about being humble, that's usually not in your mind. I mean, it's more of, being humble. I think more of not putting yourself first, not being a braggart, not being arrogant. That's kind of the flip side of humility. People think,
No, that's what you're poking at is insecurity. When I meet someone, they find out that I legally changed my last name to Awesome. They think, you must think highly of yourself. Oh, yes, I do. I think very highly of myself. Here's the thing, Eric. I also think highly of you. I don't want you to think any lower of yourself. Why would you want me to think lower of myself? So I don't want to think less of me to get on your level. What I want you to do is I want you to raise up your self-worth to get to my level.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do believe in you and I see your potential. Do you see your potential? But what I find is my confidence makes insecure people feel uncomfortable.
Yes. Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at. You know, the people, this idea of humility is like, I don't want to make myself too good because that would make you feel bad about yourself. And that's, I see that kind of attitude in a lot of places in our,
I see it in business. That's the wrong place for it to be. I am the best. And if I'm not the best, I'm going to work so hard to try to be the best because that's my goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, there's this whole idea of, you know, we, on one hand, we have the competitive society, you know, that there's competition and sports and we love the winner. But when it comes to ourselves, it's like, well, I don't want to be too good because, you know, there's a lot of psychological reasons, but people will hold themselves back.
It's an excuse. It's a crutch. Mm-hmm. It can be used as an excuse or a crutch. It doesn't need to be.
No. And it's an excuse for a fear of failure and an excuse for a fear of success.
Yeah. And ego. Ego is said to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
But an ego is the estimate of one's own self-esteem or self-importance. Do you believe that you're important enough to accomplish that thing that you want to accomplish? Because if you don't think you are, stop wasting your time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can identify with that. That was a lot of my life. You know, it was just on one hand, it was a desire to be great. And then the other hand, there's a voice inside my head going like, well, you don't deserve that. It's not, that's not you. You can't, you know, who do you think you are?
Yeah. And I think a lot of that is our culture. Someone mm-hmm. scores a touchdown and like, hey, don't celebrate your wins. We don't want anyone to feel bad. Let's hand out participation trophies. But we have to understand the system we exist within. And if you want your kids to thrive in society and in life, you have to understand that we do live in a competitive world. Like, that's what capitalism is. That's the structure that we exist within. Of course, I'm always about lifting other people up and helping other people. But I always want to be the best version of myself. But if that makes you uncomfortable, I can't stop. I can't dim my light because you don't have sunglasses.
I like that. Well, and the other thing, I mean, I've seen, it was a fictional book that I read that talked about the fact that the fact of being in a competitive society actually makes everybody better, you know, and that if you're going to go into, you know, into the marketplace or into the field or into the boxing ring, you really want your, you know, the person on the other end of, you know, that you're competing against, you want them to be as you know, at their function, at their best.
I'll give you this analogy. So the number one, the top athlete in Russia right now doesn't have the NBA or the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
So they box. In America, we don't have the greatest competition in boxing because all the great boxers are on the line of the Chiefs or LeBron James. So they have all of our freak athletes. They aren't boxing. The competitive pool in America is so shallow, even though we're a large company, a country, that it's easy for a guy who figures out a simple formula to be number one in boxing within 2 years. That's not how great I am. That's how shallow our competition pool is.
Wow. So is it just the fact that there's more money, more recognition in the NFL than there is in boxing?
I tell you, the only reason why boxing died is there's no scholarship involved in boxing.
Okay.
Because a mom will say, I'm not going to let my kid box and get brain damage, but she would put him on a football field.
Right.
Which we know which one's more dangerous. And that's not what this conversation's about. But when you have the incentive of a scholarship behind something and that culture of my son went to this college, I went to this college, so my son has to go to this college. But we can't afford to go to that college because college is very expensive. So we're going to put them in a sport.
Yeah.
So boxing doesn't have that. So.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, you talk about we had a discussion when we met in person that how much mental that boxing is a mental sport as much as it is physical. Explain that, because I mean, when I look at boxing, I think I understand, you know, maybe understand what you're talking about, but most of, you know, boxing looks like just, you know, standing there and either, you know, trying not to get hit or trying to hit the other guy.
Let me show it to you from my perspective. And this is how I looked at boxing and why I was able to be successful, because I just played mind games. So if you picked yourself, you're my opponent, right? We're about to fight. We're the heavyweight, so we're last, right? You have your play. You have your gloves on and you have your playlist already. So you have your headphones in your ear. You're hitting the gloves and the mitts and everything. You're pumped up. Your ring music plays. Now you're walking out to the ring. This is your big moment. You've been thinking about this moment for a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. You get a tap on your shoulder. It's your opponent. It's me. Hey, Eric, I just wanted to say good luck tonight. I'm sure you train very hard and let the best man win. And I go in for a hug. Eric, you know this is not genuine.
Yeah.
But you also know that ring gentlemanship and sportsmanship is a part of the judging system. So you have to hug me back. I ruined your ring walk and you had to hug me back. Now you're going to the ring. You're so mad. You forgot your game plan. You're ready to take my head off, right? You get to the ring. Then my ring music plays. Guess what song it is, Eric? It's Rocky? The national anthem.
The national anthem. Okay.
Why? Because it's the worst song ever. For that moment, everyone has to stop what they're doing, stand up, and pay attention to me. The whole energy of the building has changed from that hype music that you just had to the national anthem. Now there's a kind of awkward feeling in silence. I love awkward. Now, you've prepared mentally for almost everything, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't prepare for the match to start this way.
No.
Now, Eric, the bell rings. We get to the middle of the ring. I'm a southpaw, but you throw your the most popular punch is a jab. You throw your jab, and this is what I do in the beginning of every fight. You throw your jab, I slip it, I throw an uppercut. I land it, right? We get back to the middle of the ring. You throw a jab, I slip it, throw an uppercut. You throw a jab, I slip it, throw an uppercut. The fourth time you throw a jab, I slip it, you instinctively close your eyes because you know you're going to get hit. But then you don't get hit. So then you kind of peek your eyes open and it's me smiling. So now you know if you throw that jab again, I can hit you at will. I can hit you so easily that I'll just pass up opportunities to hit you because I can just hit you later. Mm-hmm. Now, what that does is you're now afraid to throw your jab. So if you've ever been watching a boxing match and you're like, why isn't he throwing any punches? Because I've conditioned him not to.
Interesting. And the jab is kind of, that's kind of a staple in boxing.
Yeah. And if you can't hit me and you can't throw your jab, then once I do that to your right hand, then you're not going to throw any punches. It makes it easier for me not to get hit. 1 + 2 = 3. I am one, and if I don't get hit, I will win.
You've probably heard the phrase, life isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. Whoever thought of this phrase was not a runner. Because, you know, a marathon, it sounds like a long ways to run, until you actually run a marathon. Yes, a marathon is not a sprint, but running a marathon is nothing like life. But the ultra marathon, especially when you get to those distances of 100K or 100 miles, the ultra marathon, that's what life is like. For success in an ultra marathon, you have to manage three things: your energy, your thoughts, and your emotions. And for success in life, you have to manage the same three things: your energy, your thoughts, and your emotions. If your thoughts are always racing from one thing to the next, and if your emotions are constantly making you stress out, these two things will drain your energy. If you're a regular listener here, you've heard the stories from runners who talk about how their mindset can struggle, and that struggle often leads to their body following their mindset down the hole and draining their energy and leading to difficulties in finishing a race. As a coach, I help my clients develop a strong mindset. So whether your goal is to run far or live your best life or to go after your epic thing, you know, I talk about that, you know, the epic thing, the thing that you dream of doing, I can help you get started. Go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute conversation with me. I'll help you get past your feeling of being stuck. Ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute conversation and let me get you started toward living your best life. So did that work in most cases? Was that something that worked most of the time?
That worked. Were there anybody? 95% of the time. Like, it was that easy to win. 95% of the time. 5% of the time, they didn't care about my mind games.
Yeah, I would imagine you would run across a few people who wouldn't respond.
Every so often, there's one guy, Michael Hunter. I lost to him twice. He didn't really care for my mind games. I was playing games. He was just throwing punches and walking forward. He had no interest. And there's been quite a few guys who made me fight back. But the thing is, Eric, I can fight. I just don't want to. Like, my first line of defense is mental. Like, I just want to beat you mentally. So one of the things I do is if a guy throws a hook, I can block it. I can duck it. But what I do is you throw a hook, I duck under, and then I reach out, which is dangerous to reach both hands out in boxing. And I grab your hips and I twist you around and I pull you in closely from behind. So if you imagine, you throw a hook, I duck under, I use your body momentum to spin you around and I hug you from behind.
that's a legal move?
So what I basically do is I hump you in front of everyone.
Yeah.
And then the ref separates us, turns to you and warns you for turning your back to the action.
Oh my goodness.
If I do that to you 3 times in one round, I get a point. I win the round. So those are the games I was playing.
That's interesting. It reminds me, I read a book by Tim Ferriss, I think the author of The 4-Hour Workweek. And he often would go and, Muay Thai. He went to Thailand and studied Muay Thai and used similar kinds of techniques to, he said it was using the rules in his favor. The people who fought against him said he was gaming the system. But so, he figured out how to win, similar types of techniques.
Yeah, that's they didn't like that. The old scoring system is if I hit you with a punch, I get a point. If you hit me with a punch, you get a point.
Okay.
That's where I developed my style of fighting. So if my goal was to end the fight 1-0. No one else would take that strategy. It's crazy. But because no one has ever tried it, no one has ever prepared for it.
Okay.
So guys wouldn't know how to fight me.
So you said land a punch. So what constitutes a punch? I mean, I'm assuming that the jabs are those count as well.
There's a white stripe on the gloves.
Okay.
So on the knuckle part of the gloves, if I punch you around your face or your front torso up to your belt, that's 1 point. It has to be a distinctive blow. So I can't just like touch you. It has to be kind of like a punch.
Right. Okay. So the jab, you're talking about the jab. That's more of a,
that would be a point.
That would still be a point even with the jab. Okay.
An uppercut is 1 point. A jab is 1 point. A strong right hand is 1 point.
Okay.
So in my mind, why would I waste effort throwing hard punches if I can just throw light points? Mm-hmm. And everyone was so mad that a heavyweight, because heavyweights are supposed to knock people out, and that's why people watch us.
Yeah. Yeah.
People used to watch just to watch me get knocked out because they hated me.
they were hoping for that.
Yeah, it didn't happen. Because I would never engage. Because, of course, I was afraid. These guys were so much bigger than me. So I've won more boxing matches than anyone else in the history of the sport in the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
But I had no interest in being a boxer when I grew up. I shared in the beginning, I did this for the prom date. I did this to lose weight. I did this to deal with my insecurities. But after I won my first nationals, I got to travel. And I realized I can travel for free. And after I won my first nationals, to me, that's an associate's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an associate's degree and I have a national championship, and we apply for the same job, Eric, I'm going to get the job.
Yeah.
Like, I understand the system in which we exist, right? In America, we value athletes. Mm-hmm. So after winning my fourth or fifth national championship, I realized, well, if you have a bachelor's degree, Eric, and I have my five national championships, and as long as it's not like a job like a nurse or a doctor or engineer,
mm-hmm.
Even a marketing, if I would get a marketing job before you, and I don't know nothing about marketing, I'm an athlete. So I realized why, if this formula worked, I can rack up national championships, gain life experience, and then leverage that for a career for after sports. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to go to the Olympics, win, and get a television show. That's what my goal was.
Okay.
It's in 2008 when I won my first national championships, they asked what was my goal out of boxing, and they like announced it when they announced you in the ring. And mine was to be a good role model and have a TV show. That okay. was
that. What kind of TV show? What was just
when I was a kid, there was a show called All That.
Okay.
It was like Saturday Night Live, but children. And okay. Kenan Thompson from Saturday Night Live, he was on All That as a kid. Okay. And he got his own spinoff show, Kenan and Kel. And I thought if I got on All That, I could get my own TV show too. So in my process of thinking as a kid was if I win nationals, if I win the Olympics, I get on TV, an agent will see me. I'll practice a lot, get good at acting and get my own TV show. Because I would do I just didn't want to work. I didn't want to have a conventional job.
Okay.
That was always my motive. There's nothing against the conventional job. It was just that everyone I knew with a job was poor. Everyone mm-hmm. in my family, everyone around me, all you know is what's around you. Mm-hmm. And everyone around me with a job was poor. And the only people more poor than someone with a job is someone with two jobs, Eric. So in my yeah. mind, I was like, I need to get rich. And the only way to do that is through sports, TV, or music. And I was terrible at music. I wasn't good at sports. And I figured I would do TV. Then I stumbled into boxing. I found that equation. And I thought I could use that to get to TV.
Okay.
I mean, I got a documentary on Netflix.
I was going to say, you did get to TV. You have a Netflix. So how did that come about? I mean, your Netflix documentary.
In 2012, after I realized what a negative person I became after becoming sober, I wanted to symbolically kill off my old self and be reborn into a new person. So I threw a party on my half birthday, and I call it my after birthday party, and I legally changed my last name to Awesome. I did it. Symbolically, one, I wanted to kill off my old self. A few reasons. Reason number two, Eric, if someone thought the world wasn't that seriously, if someone's like, hey, life's not that serious, wouldn't they want to change their last name to Fossum, but then realize that's inappropriate because they want to be a youth speaker and then just change their middle name to the letter F? So at yeah. schools, they're Cam Awesome and everywhere else, they're Cam F Awesome? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, well, I saw it was Cam F. Awesome, and I kind of figured out what that F stood for because Well, and it was interesting. I was talking with a previous podcast guest, Shannon Mick, and we were talking about ultramarathon mantras used in ultramarathons. You know, similar to what you said, if you know, telling yourself that you were doing, you know, you could do it. You know, ultramarathon runners, when we get out in the middle of the night, you know, often we use mantras. You know, you can do this, you can do this. And she said that there's been studies done that if you actually use profanity when you are using those mantras, they are more effective. when you say your full name, it is more effective than that.
I believe so. And I would so much go to saying that, and I know sometimes I come off a little abrasive because I do believe in myself and unapologetically. But the thing is, I want everyone to believe in themselves unapologetically, because that's all you actually need to accomplish what you need to in life is to actually believe you can.
Yes.
But too many people are worried about not sounding like they can. And that's being humble. So yeah, but it's mantras. I'm very big on positive affirmations. And it's funny that you say doing it with curse words, because I do affirmations a little different. Basically, affirmations are sometimes just wins that you're reminding yourself you're having. And I do mine with cursing. I'm big on post-it notes. This is this week's post-it note.
I like that.
Yeah. Because profanity, why not? Right?
Why not? Yeah. Well, it's kind of – go ahead.
No.
No, I was going through some you know, self-doubt and, you know, I was getting ready to do a presentation, and something happened. Somebody said something that just kind of cut, you know, it was like all the progress I felt like I'd made, it had been cut out from underneath me. I said, I need to do something. It's like, okay. So I did the positive affirmations, and I put on post-it notes, I am an ass kicking name taking winner. Well, my grandkids were living in my house at the time, my daughter and my grandkids were living here. I'm like, okay, I don't know that I want to have ass kicking, you know, post-it all, because I put it on every light switch and on the refrigerator. And it's like, so every time I would encounter a light switch, I would say this to myself. But so I just put I am, and I filled in the rest of it. <It's> like,
I love that. So one thing that I'm very big on, and it's a lot of work to believe in yourself like this, because you have to actually do the work. Because that's I walked to the ring with that confidence because I didn't skip a single workout. I dedicated myself. But the same goes with happiness. Like, it's intentional. I read Think and Grow Rich, completely changed my life, right? And all that book does is teach you how to focus your mind on money, because what you focus your mind on, you will find. And I figured, if this works with money, because it does, could it work with happiness? What would that look like? So every morning I start a routine, because your phone is filled with negativity. Every time I open my phone every day, someone I grew up loving died. Like some movie star, someone's dying every day, and you're just – there's famine, there's war, school shootings, negativity in your phone every day. And that's how we start our day. Your alarm rings, you look at your phone, you see what time it is, and you check your notifications. Who's dead? Isn't that a crazy way to start our day?
That's a crazy way to start the day. For me, it comes down to choices, because, you know, there are things that I have on my phone that I know that I'm going to go to. I don't focus on those things. I mean, my notifications, you know, I ignore all those notifications. It's like I have a YouTube channel that I pull open and I listen to the latest, you know, the latest that this guy's got on his YouTube channel. So, but it's a choice. I mean, you have to intentionally do that. Before we used to have TV on overnight, and you know, it's like the news was always that. There was always
that's sort of
calamity. Yeah.
So what I did is to start my day with, because I believe if you don't purposely plant positivity, weeds will grow. So what are you doing with your garden? So I wanted to purposely plant positivity every morning when I woke up. So what I did was, before I looked at my phone, I would write a list of 10 things I'm grateful for every morning.
Okay.
I am grateful for fill in the blank. I'm grateful for my house. I'm grateful for my car. I'm grateful for my washer. I'm grateful for my dryer. Those are two different things. You could be grateful for everything, Eric.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And every day I come up with a new 10 things. After a month, you have 300 reasons why you should wake up on day number 31.
I like that.
A lot of
so
people.
So you didn't repeat anything. It was like if you put it down once, you couldn't repeat it again.
And that's where I ran into my first problem. It started to take me 15 to 20, sometimes 30 minutes to come up with 10 new things every morning. And I really wanted to look at my phone. So I found a cheat around it. I would find things to be grateful for throughout my day and store it in my memory so I can write my list faster the next morning.
And so what did that do for you?
I didn't realize it at the time, but are you familiar with your reticular activated system?
Yes. Yes. So go ahead and explain it for people who may not be.
So, well, I'm not a doctor.
neither am I.
But if I were, I'd have a great doctor name.
Okay.
To club, your brain takes in 40 billion bits of information every moment, not every second, every moment, moment. If your brain would take all of that in, it melts. So what your RAS acts as a filter. So it lets you see what you're already finding. So what you're seeing, even in your peripheral, your unconscious mind is seeing it, but it's only your conscious mind is only allowed to see certain things. So for example, if you are going to buy a yellow car and then you start to see yellow cars everywhere,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that there are more yellow cars now?
Yeah, you do. You believe that. Yeah. And a particular brand. I mean, it's just like they multiply overnight.
Yeah. But do you think that's actual fact or is that perception?
No, that's just perception.
And it's all perception. So when I started to look for things to be grateful for all day and then start my day with gratitude, I hijacked my RAS. So then my life started to be filled with gratitude. And it's not that there are more things to be grateful for than there were before. It's just that I'm able to be aware of so many things that I can be grateful for. And I swear to you, Eric, sometimes I just get flushed with joy and I can't explain it. And that is just gratitude. It's completely changed my life. Now, caveat on this list, I challenge everyone to do this for 90 days. And if it doesn't change your life in 90 days, come talk to me.
Okay.
But you can't add anyone's name to the list unless you reach out to them that day out of context and tell them that you appreciate them and you're grateful that they're in your life.
Okay. You mean, okay.
This is what it would look like.
What do you mean out of context? You mean like you're not, it's not like somebody you're around all the time. You actually think of them and you contact them and tell them.
Because you're going to get looking for things to be grateful for. You're going to like, oh, I'll just add names to the list. No. You can't just add names to the list to get it over quickly. Because if you do add a name to the list, you have to reach out to them. So that would just look like me messaging my friend Serge in Syracuse, New York. And I'll send him a picture of us having lunch. Like, hey, Serge, miss you. Love you. Can't wait to hang out with you. Have lunch with you again. Tell your family I said what's up. And I just send him that message.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he responds or not, that's going to bring a smile to his face.
Right.
Now, through doing this for over, I've been doing this every day. I haven't missed a single day, every day for over a year. Now I have friends randomly reach out to me and tell me they appreciate me or send me a picture of puppies or something. Gratitude is contagious.
Yes. I like that. That, well, and then, you know, talking about the things that you look for, you will tend to find. I mean, that if you're looking for things to be grateful for, you can find those.
Yeah.
And it's the same way it works the opposite as well. If you're looking for something to, you know, if you're looking for problems, you can certainly find those as well.
Oh yeah. And that's the thing. That's what people focus on. So I realized when I started this, I start my day with 10 wins every morning, 10 things I'm grateful for. Most people, all they do is think like, I did this, this didn't work out and this didn't work out. But how many times do you stop and say, oh, this worked and I like this and this is good. I'm telling you right now, if I ever get stuck I have journal after journal of books I can open. And any page I open up, there's 10 wins. I have probably about 7 journals now. This is my most current journal. They're always around me. And it has completely changed my life. And the crazy thing is, Eric, gratitude's free.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't cost anything.
It does not cost a thing.
Yeah.
And so I think so many of us, I know some of the things that I've been working on and looking at is that there's so many things out there that, that we can put into our life. You know, you talk about books that you read, you know, reading so many times. I know I've read books and like it entertained my mind. It entertained my intellect, but I didn't take anything and didn't take it and do anything with it. It's like, well, I intended to, I thought about it. And if I would have done the things that were in there that I read, you know, could have totally, totally transformed my life, but I just didn't. And there's so much out there for free that, you know, we could do and use that we don't.
Yep. Think about anything that you've accomplished in life or anything that you figured out that you can duplicate. Whatever it is you do for a living, think about anything you can duplicate. And if you were to write down all the steps confidently and tell a person, if you did all these things, you would accomplish this. 100%. You know, it's true that there's no hooks. Of course, there's going to be a little bit of work, but you can give them a guideline and you would tell 100 people what they need to do and they're not going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I do now when I read books, if I'm going to waste my time reading a book, I'm willing to waste my energy to go grab a pen to do whatever exercise there is at the end of the chapter. Mm-hmm. Because if you can respect someone enough to read what they tell you to do, and then you can say, oh, okay, I'll do that later. Well, the reason why you're reading the book in the first place is because you haven't found a way to get that thing done. How about you stop putting things on and procrastinating and don't go on to that next chapter until the answers are there. All the information is free.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, I've been guilty of that. I've been read a book called Breath. It's one called The Oxygen Advantage, which was about breathing. And then another one called Breath by James Nestor. And as I was reading it, I was like, this book is going to change my life. And it has, you know, I have totally changed the way I breathe. And, you know, but it was like, okay, wait a minute. It wasn't just the book that changed my life. It was the fact that I saw the value of what was there. And like, if I put this into practice, it will change my life. And that was the thing that changed my life.
Oh, okay. Let's talk on that for a second. It sounded like such a simple statement, what you said, and you're too intelligent, which means I missed something and there's something powerful there. You said, I learned how to breathe differently. Now,
yes.
That sounds very like everyone knows how to breathe. So it's like simple. We can all breathe. So there's a deeper meaning there. What has breathing done for you?
Breathing has allowed me to control. Well, not control. Breathing has allowed me to manage the state of my body. And therefore, my emotions and my thoughts. And so I my mindset coaching work, you know, I did a lot of mindset work, managing my thoughts and my emotions, but learning how to breathe was like on steroids.
Wow.
And so the breath practice that I do, I mean, I can lower my blood. If I have something like, you know, when I go to the hospital, go to the doctor and have my blood pressure taken, a lot of times you get tense. And so your blood pressure elevates. Well, the breathing that they tell you to do to supposedly calm you down isn't really effective, but I can just within a matter of 30, 45 seconds, lower my blood pressure just with my breath. So managing the state of my body, which also in turn affects my emotions, which affects the way I think. So yes, that's a thumbnail sketch.
I like that. I've stumbled on a similar practice, might be similar, just most boxers, and the reason why I was able to test the guy's tank and make sure he gets tired before I do is I was able to remain calm in chaotic moments. Mm-hmm. And I would always control, even in the most tense, uncontrollable moments, I was always calm. And I can gather my breath and my composure within the first 10 seconds of the 60-second break. Most guys, you look there the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm able to control it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do that as a runner. I mean, that was part of my, part of what I started me looking toward breath. Cause as a runner, you know, trying to use the oxygen the best way that you can. And I'm very similar. I can be at the top of a hill, and heart rate would be very, very high. And I can, you know, by breath recover within just in a few seconds.
Yeah, that's because I'm Mr. Mental Toughness and all that type of stuff. But runners, that's a whole nother type of mental, like running without music. Like I have such respect for runners. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's this podcast is primarily toward runners.
Really?
Okay. Ultra marathon runners. But yeah, it's the mindset, you know, because, you know, for, you know, an ultra marathon, I say mile 73 is where you really come down to where your mental game has to be strong. When you're 73 miles in and you still have, you know, 20 some to go.
I bring snacks for a 73 mile drive.
Well, we bring snacks on a 73 mile run too.
Yours is a little more justifiable. So do you run without music?
I run without music. Yeah, I concentrate on, for me, the mindset is very much integrated with my body. And so I really tune into what my body's doing. I think probably similar to your training for boxing, and you have an awareness of your body and what's going on that, I think.
I took the opposite approach there.
Really?
So the awareness of your body, I realize when I hear myself breathe or I understand when I think about what I'm doing, that's when I get tired. So okay. I realize if I can get lost in stories and music, I can work out for 20 minutes longer, let's say, right? And if you and I are working out and I can work out, we're both fighters and I can work out 20 minutes longer than you. And then I work out six times a week, that's an hour. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an hour more. That's an hour more than you a week. That's 50 hours more than you a year.
Yes.
So if I can just numb myself to my feelings and disassociate completely, I can work out for just a little bit longer. And what I would remind myself is no one really dies from exhaustion the way we think they do.
That's true. That's true. Now, and I understand the strategy, and I know runners who run with music, and I can understand that strategy. For me, you know, both strategies work, and there are runners that dissociate, you know, I've talked to runners who have finished their 100-mile run with stress fractures, and they've run, you know, 25 miles with a stress fracture in their leg by dissociating the pain.
Yeah.
But there are also runners that I know that you know, and I'm one of those that there is an awareness of what's going on in your body and an acceptance of the pain and acceptance of the discomfort and acceptance. And so it's a tuning in to an awareness of, you know, and then that's what I practice. And as I run, it's very much being, you call it being in your body, being in the moment, you know, it's like a meditation. So that's my approach. I know that, you know, music and dissociation works as well.
Actually, I wouldn't say I couldn't do it, because now I see that as like a challenge. Maybe I need to start forcing myself to run without music, just to do something that I haven't done, or challenge myself. But it is more honestly, it is more challenging without music. And you said accepting the pain. I think that's where I fall short. And mm-hmm. I think I need to accept the pain.
Yeah. And that is, it's different. And see, I practice that in my meditation as well. And you know, my meditation is very body focused. I, you know, my mind is engaged and I'm getting constantly getting feedback from what's going on in my body. And so I've learned to even, you know, deal with cramps. And so, oftentimes in a stretch, if my muscle will cramp, I don't just immediately stop and try to relieve it. I can, with focusing with this awareness, I can focus on sending a signal to that to relax without changing position, and actually just, you know, cause that cramp to stop, because of the fact that that's, I practice that was in my.
It's like, that's what your brain is so capable. And I think that, I guess we're society, I'm blessed. We live in a very safe bubble wrapped world where we like, but our brain is capable of pushing our body so much further.
Yes.
But it's also capable of limiting us so much.
Yes.
Beyond recognition.
Yeah. And it's the power of your mind is, you know, that's really, you know, there are a lot, I think, and you know, you and I, there are a lot of people who are out there who are kind of looking for our own way to tap into that power. And so, you know, you did it through boxing. You know, I've kind of taken the approach for runners, and runners kind of understand that, but it works for life. I mean, you've put it into your goals of what you want to accomplish in life. And that's really why we do the sport. I mean, that's for those of us who go out and kind of test ourselves. Is like, well, yeah, we want to run. We enjoy that test, but it's take that and apply it to what you want from your life and make your, you know, become your best, the best version of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that the idea of getting up and going running when you're sore and you don't really want to, when dealing with, and what's the best way to put it? Voluntary discomfort is the greatest way to grow.
Yes.
Making yourself do something you don't have to do, but you're allowing yourself to do that. Once you can build up strength to do that, later on in life, when you have to do something in business or you have to try a second attempt at something, you've understood what it is to do something you don't really feel like doing.
Yes.
And it's not that big of a deal.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Cam, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate your time. How can people get a hold of you?
You can find me at camfawesome.com or at camfawesome on all social media platforms. Looking forward to connect with anyone.
Okay. Before you go, I have what I call the bridge questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he sees.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
In your training, what is the most kind of your must-have piece of gear that you use in your training?
Well, my mouthpiece. I had a dental mouthpiece that was custom-made for my mouth. It was like a suction cup. A lot of guys get hit and the mouthpiece comes out. You lose a point for that. That's the whole round.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm not going to lose a point for that. So if I can borrow a grind protector from someone. I can box in my sneakers, but I can't fight without my mouthpiece. That's my bread and butter.
Okay. That's good. Okay. And number two, what is the strangest thing that you've ever seen as you've in all of your fights? What's the strangest thing that's ever happened?
I was winning this fight, and it was a big fight against this big Russian guy. He came to America from Russia, and we made it to the finals, the National Golden Gloves. And I'm winning this fight and no one thinks I'm supposed to win. Like, and he's this big guy and this tiny guy and he throws a punch and I go to block it. And I felt like I was falling for a long time. And like, I open my eyes and I'm outside of the ring on my back. The entire ring had collapsed and I flew out of the ring, hit my head on the judges' table. And my coach ran over to me and he's like, hey, they're sending over a stretcher. If a stretcher gets you up, they're not going to let you fight. The choice is yours. And I'm like,
so the guy didn't hit you. It was just the ring.
Yeah. So when I went to move out of the way of the punch and I leaned on the ropes and the ring just collapsed and it was like a seesaw because it's a wood plank. the guy went down in the middle of the ring and it shot me up.
Oh no.
Yeah. And I shot up out of the ring. But I got out of, after I got up, kind of regained myself at Nationals, there's three rings. So we left our ring. We went to a second ring to finish the last 42 seconds of the round. And that's how I won my first Golden Glove Nationals.
That's a cool story. Okay. Third question. What is your, what word or phrase sums up your life philosophy?
If you can fail without being discouraged, success becomes inevitable.
I like that. I like
if you that. Can fail without being discouraged, success becomes inevitable. I would say that because my goal in boxing, sometimes your goal from afar is a lot different when you get up close to it. And when I started boxing, I was like, I'm going to go to the Olympics and then I'll get a TV show. But I, 2008, I tried out for the Olympics trials. I lost. 2012, I won, but I got suspended and kicked off the Olympic team. Returned to boxing, regained my spot as the number one boxer in the country and as team captain of the USA national boxing team. Won nationals every year until 2016. Won the Olympic trials. Lost an international competition and didn't get to go to Rio.
Okay.
Continued boxing. Lived in a van. Built my speaking business. Living in a van, speaking at schools, emceeing festivals, emceeing galas, doing stand-up comedy, and speaking at corporations. The United States Olympic Committee wouldn't allow me to box if I was still working. So I flew to my dad's country of Trinidad Tobago, won, fought in the Olympic trials, got dual citizenship, came back to America, won their Olympic trials, and then the pandemic happened. So I've yet to make it to the Olympics, but I've won more boxing matches than anyone else in the history of the sport, and I'm the most decorated boxer. And my greatness didn't come from the fact that I'm athletic or anything good, except the fact that I'm resilient. It's just I fought more than everyone. I don't have the best winning percentage, but I'm going to fight more than anyone.
I like that. I like that. That's great. Thank you a lot for being here, Cam. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultra Marathon Mindset Podcast. I do enjoy being able to spend time with you here each week. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. The show notes for this episode and others are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can find this week's guest there. More information, links to their social media and website. There's also a podcast player there if you want to share this episode with somebody who does not normally listen to podcasts and doesn't have a podcast player on their phone. You can also find links there for my Amazon affiliate link, Crush Your Goals course, a short course I made to help you get your goals in order. Also, you can schedule a chat with me. My online calendar is there. All of these links are at the sidebar if you're on a laptop, or you have to scroll clear to the bottom if you are on a phone. If you did enjoy this episode and you do not know somebody who might like it, take it just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. Remember that an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. You need a strong mindset for success no matter what your goal in life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Thank you again for listening. I'll see you next time.